It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, we have been exploring the unexpected aspects of our state during Iowa Week. Our talk show team has been bubbling with enthusiasm about all the surprising things in our history, in our culture. We hope that you've been bubbling right along as you've been listening to Iowa Week. Today, Iowa's unexpected role as a civil rights leader. Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain. Now, we know this from grade school. That is, if you grew up here in Iowa. Iowa's state motto demonstrates how seriously our founders took the principles of freedom and equality. Back in 1868, Ulysses S. Grant called Iowa a bright, radical star. And that's a reputation that sprang from our state's role in granting and protecting civil rights long before many other states in our union, the United States. This hour, we want to explore why Iowa judges have ruled in favor of extending rights in a whole series of cases dating back to the 19th century, all the way up to as recently as the Varnum decision in 2009, a decision that made Iowa the third state in the union to allow same-sex marriage. Joining us for the entire hour to do that, we have in Des Moines, Russell Lovell. He's a professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School. Russell Lovell, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben, for including me in the program.
And Camilla Taylor joins us by phone for the first half of the program. Camilla Taylor is the Marriage Project Director for Lambda Legal. She served as lead counsel on the team that brought the Varnum case. It's the one that cleared the way for the same-sex marriage ruling in Iowa in 2009. Hello, Camilla.
Thanks so much for having me.
We want to play a little historical audio. This is audio from April 3rd, 2009, when the decision came down. Camilla Taylor, you are announcing the decision in the Varnum case to the plaintiffs.
We won. Yeah. Yes, for that. It is unanimous.
Camilla Taylor, I'm sure you remember that day and always will. Ben Stone is with us as well in our Iowa City studio, former executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. Ben Stone, welcome back to our program.
I'm very glad to be with you, Ben.
And I understand you wrote a master's thesis on why Iowa has this civil rights tradition in the legislative sense.
Yeah, I wrote it about the period from 1947 to 1965, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we want to reach out to our audience, too, this hour. Why do you think Iowa has been a leader in expanding and protecting civil rights? We want you to go to our Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, join in the conversation. What's special about Iowa's courts, our government, our culture that's made this role possible? 1-866-780-9100, or leave us a note, a question, a comment on our Facebook page. Write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Camilla Taylor, let's go back to you and start with you. Let's work in a little bit of a reverse order, starting with that 2009 decision. Why did Lambda Legal choose Iowa when deciding where to file this suit? Because people should know this was not out of the blue that Iowa was chosen, was it?
Not at all. And it was very early days in the marriage movement. And now, when we have 19 states in the District of Columbia that allow same-sex couples to marry, and there have been 42 victories, excuse me, just in the last year since the Windsor decision came down in federal and state courts around the country, it's hard to think back to those days when Massachusetts stood alone out of all of the states in the country in allowing same-sex couples to marry. And it was then, in 2005, that we chose to bring suit in Iowa, and we thought that Iowa might open the door for equality, not only here in the Midwest, but around the country. And there were a lot of factors that we considered. The civil rights history of Iowa and its courage, as we used to refer to it, in agreeing to be first, really, in recognizing the rights of women and of people of color in all sorts of different contexts. That was very significant.
And we'll go into some of those cases in a little bit more depth later in the hour, but go on, yes.
There was also, I think, a very important factor, which was the level of political engagement of people in Iowa. And Iowa's population is extremely well-educated. And as our co-counsel, Denny Johnson, who was a former Solicitor General of Iowa, used to say, Iowa juries are second to none. So there's a very thoughtful live-and-let-live type of approach that Iowans take to people who are different from themselves And that was extremely important to us.
But if this was a court decision, why would that matter that the people are engaged?
Well, I think courts are not isolated on an island somewhere. They're products of the society in which the judges live. And I think there had to be a recognition among the judges who were going to be hearing our case that the time had come to treat lesbian and gay Iowans fairly and to treat them on the same plane in the same fair way as all other Iowans. So that was significant.
Just on this point, did you have states, for instance, where the court may have decided in a similar fashion, but there would have been the likelihood of a backlash? Did you think about that?
Absolutely, we did. The absence of a backlash or the ability to hold back against a backlash was extremely important, too. So that was another factor that was considered up at the top. We had to make sure that the political situation was not going to deteriorate as a result of a lawsuit such that, you know, there'd be legislation passed that would discriminate or target lesbian and gay people, or a constitutional amendment, for example, that would completely roll back any victory that we could get in court. And we had some confidence that we could do that. And indeed, we filed our case in December of 2005, and then in mid-2006, the legislature did pass a bill that actually prohibited discrimination against people based on their sexual orientation and their gender identity. So it did hold true that the legislature was able to not only hold back backlash against lesbian and gay people, but actually advance civil rights at the same time.
It turned out there was a backlash. Three of our Supreme Court justices lost their jobs.
That's true. There was an election that was the result of a lot of out-of-state money that flowed in 2010 that resulted in three of the justices who joined that unanimous decision being not retained in a what was supposed to be a routine retention election, which was not supposed to be a referendum on any particular case. The following election cycle, though, Justice Wiggins, who was also part of that unanimous decision, retained his seat. So I think there was a degree of chagrin and regret at the ability to alter that retention election that Iowans saw from all of that out-of-state money. I mean, I think it's significant that the justices themselves found it unseemly to campaign. They didn't think that that was appropriate for a judge. And so they didn't.
We've had a remaking of the public face of our Iowa Supreme Court since that time, with them holding a court, so to speak, all across the state to raise awareness about what they actually do and what their role is. Camilla Taylor, Marriage Project Director for Lambda Legal. Ben Stone, let me turn to you as former executive director of the ACLU. We heard there about the context in which Lambda Legal made the decision to file this suit here. Fill us in a little bit more on the precursors, the reasons that Lambda Legal had or that anyone would have in looking at the legal history in Iowa to have confidence that this might be a state that could take a step forward before others.
Well, I think Iowans should really take great pride in the remarkable quality of the government that the people put together here. It goes back to the original, the versions of the Constitution that we have, 1857 and on. But really, in the 1960s, the Constitution was amended to create this system where judges are not elected. You know, in a lot of states, judges run ads on TV and they're, vote for me, vote for me. They go out and solicit money from people. And it's really unseemly. And people that have grown up here and have lived here their lives, they don't know how horrible that would be. So that's really, we have a truly independent judiciary, which is key to justice. You don't want mob mentality overriding a judge's sense of justice. And I think also worth mentioning is the fact that Iowa has, probably one of the most extraordinary methods of reapportionment. Every 10 years there's a new census, and then they redraw the lines for the Congress. And, and Iowa's just got this amazingly logical and reasonable and non-political way. There is no gerrymandering in the state of Iowa. It's just, we got
one of the very few states.
One of very few. And I think that, that makes the politics more reasonable. And so I think that and then lastly and probably most important to the particular issue of the Varnum case was it's really quite difficult to amend the Iowa Constitution. It takes two consecutive identical votes in terms of the wording in two consecutive general assemblies. That's every 2 years. And then it has, and then it goes to the people for a vote on the next general election. So it takes, you know, anywhere from 3 to 7 years mm-hmm. for that to happen. And so that made Iowa a good choice. And one can argue that that's a part of good government, too. You don't get, you know, you look at Oregon and California, they just get dozens of these often quite strange.
It's too easy. That hurdle, yes. There aren't enough hurdles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Ben Stone, former executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. Russell Lovell, a professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School. Take us back to what makes Iowa's Constitution special. Who were the framers? What was their intent when it came to civil rights? What are the key words that make this history possible?
Well, the initial Constitution was in 1846, and that Constitution had lots of racial classifications and exclusions. So we tout, and I guess we'll have a chance to talk later about the landmark decision in 1839 by the Supreme Court, the very first decision that freed Ralph a slave. But we tout that, but at the same time, that first Constitution had many racial classifications. It was followed in 1851 by statutes that actually totally excluded even free blacks from entering the state of Iowa, if you can believe that. So, I mean, clearly black codes did exist at that time, including in all kinds of discrimination against the free blacks that were already in Iowa. But in 1857, led extensively by Alexander Clark, who, when we talk about some of the reasons that Iowa was more progressive on this, we can't overlook the extraordinary importance of that African-American leader from Muscatine. And I hope
not a name I know from grade school. Perhaps others don't know. Who was Alexander Clark?
Well, there's a documentary that PBS did. It's on Iowa Public Television just about a year and a half ago. And so I encourage it's a 30 minutes. It's an exceptional piece. Several historians, including Paul Finkelman, who has written, so characterizes him as the most important African American west of the Mississippi in the period from 1840 to 1880. He was a barber in Muscatine, but also a businessman, and he was a leader in the Underground Railroad. It had a lot to do with in terms of helping slaves, particularly from Missouri, to escape. And in Iowa, had a significant role there. He was very active in trying to overturn the racial exclusion laws when the Constitutional Convention took place in 1857. He was one of those who believed, like Frederick Douglass, that if African Americans were ever to have the real benefits of citizenship, they had to share all of the sacrifices, all the burdens of citizenship. And so he was very active in recruiting African Americans to volunteer for the Union Army during the Civil War. Following that, he was the leader in terms of organizing those same black veterans to come back and again petition the Iowa legislature for a constitutional amendment that would allow African Americans to vote in Iowa. His daughter, Susan Clark, was the named plaintiff. With him as the guardian of her, that led the landmark case of Clark versus Muscatine that held that racial segregation in the public schools of Iowa was unconstitutional under the Iowa Constitution.
And the year on that one?
That's 1868.
So there we have the context for Ulysses S. Grant's comment, his, quote, bright radical star in reference to Iowa. That's the context.
Absolutely. I mean, this case came down that the very year that he made that comment, a few months after Ulysses Grant made that comment, Iowa became, I think, only the second state to approve that blacks could vote prior to the 15th Amendment, at least in that era. So, there's an extraordinary history of civil rights. One more thing about Alexander Clark that I think is really important is that not only did they win that case, but then his son became the first African-American graduate of the University of Iowa College of Law. And Clark himself, I've forgotten his age, but he was at least, I think, 50 years old. He also graduated from the University of Iowa Law School in the top 10% of his class. And so, an extraordinary contribution by Alexander Clark, I think, had because this was at a time you have to realize that, you know, most blacks, including those who were free, had almost no opportunities for education or to move into the professions and to be able to exhibit their intelligence in creative and imaginative ways. And here was, you know, here was an African-American man that was one of the great leaders in Iowa at that time. And I think that was influential to other whites who could then begin to perceive that, hey, you know, blacks not only should be free, but they should have they should be equal, you know.
Russell Lovell, a professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School, you mentioned two versions of the state constitution, 1846, if I'm remembering right, and 1857. The 1857 version is our version now with
– There have been amendments from it, but that would still be the principal document. One of the major changes in 1857 was in the very first clause of the Bill of Rights clause of the Constitution, which is in the Iowa Constitution. It comes at the front end, not as an attack on – or an amendment is in the federal constitution, but they changed the language there, which had previously talked in terms of independence to equality. That one word changed in 1857 really made a commitment to equality. It was not a full-fledged commitment to equality.
So the sentence in which that takes place is independence gets changed to equality.
Yeah, let me see if I can get you the exact language here.
I think it was all men are free and equal. Mm-hmm.
That's right. All men are by nature free and equal, as opposed to the prior, I read all men are by nature free and independent. And then it goes on to mirror language from the Declaration of Independence.
Hmm. Camilla, how much of the history were you aware of when you we're planning the Varnum case, because you're surveying all the states in the union.
Well, we went into very in-depth research on Iowa's history because we knew that we would have to depend on it in court as a justification for why Iowa should be a first mover. And I should mention that I think that free and equal language predated the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution, which is one of the things that was so significant about it. The other thing that I don't want to get lost is the contribution of Iowa women. And while Alexander Clark was an incredible figure and civil rights leader, there was also this amazing woman, Emma Coger. I think that's how you pronounce her name, but perhaps Russell can correct me if I'm wrong. But she, in 1873, won a case that desegregated public accommodations. And this was an Iowa Supreme Court case that involved this woman being forcibly removed from a whites-only dining room in a steamboat that was operating off of Iowa's shores. And the Supreme Court found that the steamboat company could not exclude her from this dining space based on her race. And even though it criticized her for lacking the delicacy that's preferred in members of her sex, nevertheless, she prevailed in that case, which is also, I think, a very significant part of Iowa's history.
Indeed. You wanted to finish up there, Camilla.
Well, Iowa was also a leader in allowing married women to own property much before any of the neighboring territories or states. And it also allowed a woman to be admitted to the bar to be a lawyer, first documented case in the country. And that was 3 years before the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case involving an Illinois married woman who was trying to be admitted to the Illinois bar that she did not have a right to be a lawyer guaranteed by any principle in the Constitution, because women were not well suited for that and it was too aggressive and dirty for them.
Mm. Camilla Taylor with us, Russell Lovell and Ben Stone with us as we're looking back to to look at Iowa's long civil rights history and how the Varnum case comes at the end of it. And there are far too many cases to discuss in depth in even an hour as we're recalling names from the past and cases from the past. Ben Stone, jump in here.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that it's not just the judges. I mean, the legislature of Iowa was very progressive at times as well. About the same time in the 1870s, the Supreme Court, actually it was the 1880s, the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated several civil rights laws. And Iowa was one of four states, I think it was the fourth state in the country, to adopt its own Iowa statute that required equal protection and public accommodation. So, again, that you know, bright radical star comment.
And really what year is this?
That was in the 1884.
So we're ahead of the rest of the country by decades.
Yeah, and that's legislators. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. that's, you know, men in the Iowa legislature, all white men, but
And,
Russell Lovell, yeah.
And the legislature in 1884, incredibly, that was a unanimous vote on that civil rights statute.
That, I didn't know that, Russ. That's fascinating.
It followed the U.S. Supreme Court in 1883 had struck down a federal public accommodation statute as exceeding Congress's power under the 13th and 14th Amendment. And so, you know, it was the beginning of a retrenchment by the U.S. Supreme Court at the federal level. But Iowa responded immediately within 1 year with the statute, and it was incredibly, it was a unanimous vote.
Did this have anything to do with Iowa's role in the Civil War? Per capita, Iowa put more soldiers into the Union Army than any other Union state, didn't it?
Yes, and we also had a major, I mean, again, Alexander Clark was really successful, and I've seen different reports, but I think as many as 700 African-Americans volunteered to serve, from Iowa, volunteered to serve in the Union Army, and I'm a big believer that that was made a huge difference in the attitudes of Iowans. In 1857, we talked about the Constitution that was adopted then.
Mm-hmm.
They put on the ballot the issue of whether African Americans would be allowed to vote in Iowa, and it was resoundingly defeated in the elections of 1858. Something like 49,000. Against to something like 8,000 and four that were for. I mean, it was like 8-1. But they put it back on the ballot, and it was, you know, again, the leadership of Alexander Clark. It was put back on the ballot by the two constitutional conventions, and it was voted in 1868. Just again, you know, in that talk that you quoted by U.S. Grant, you know, he was talking about Iowa, the bright radical star, I am confident, is going to approve the right to vote for African Americans in the upcoming election, and indeed they did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. The civil rights of all Americans protected by law, but it was not always the case. You know, when the U.S. was first founded, people of color did not have the right to vote in local or state or national elections. Women couldn't own property, hold public office, or vote. State and federal laws did not protect the civil rights of all citizens of the United States. This hour, Iowa's unexpected pioneering role in granting these rights before many other states. We hope you'll join our conversation on our Facebook page, where the conversation continues. Why do you think Iowa has been a leader in expanding and protecting civil rights? We want to get more into that question when we return with our guest, Camilla Taylor of Lambda Legal, Russell Lovell, law professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School, and Ben Stone, former executive director of the ACLU, back with more in just a few minutes. It's River to River. Glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, we've been exploring the unexpected aspects of our state during Iowa Week here on River to River, also on Talk of Iowa at 10 o'clock. Today on this program, Iowa's unexpected role as a civil rights leader. We're exploring why Iowa judges have ruled in favor of extending rights in a whole series of cases dating back to the 19th century, all the way up to as recently as the Varnum decision in 2009, that decision making the Iowa one of the very earliest states in allowing same-sex marriage. Camilla Taylor was with us. She could only spend the first half hour with us of Lambda Legal. Joining us still, Russell Lovell is professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School, and Ben Stone, former executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. And let's talk about some of these other high points, too. Also, the people that brought suits, people that had the power of the law there, but where, if not having filed a suit or taken some action, nothing would have happened. Let's go back to Ralph. We mentioned that as a case in Iowa history. Can we rely on you, Russell, for that? What is Ralph all about?
Ralph is the very first decision of the Iowa Supreme Court. It occurred in 1839 when we were still a territory. There is a wonderful monument to this decision on the grounds of the Iowa Supreme Court building in Des Moines, about 100 feet to the west as it looks out over the city of Des Moines. And it's just been built in about 2.5 years ago. I encourage listeners to stop by and check it out. I'll tell you a little bit more about it as it goes. Ralph was a slave in Missouri, and his master, Montgomery, cut a deal and said that you can earn your freedom by going up to the lead mines in Iowa, up around Dubuque, And if you pay me $550, you will have your freedom. So he went to the mines near Dubuque and I think also over by Galena in Illinois and worked there apparently for about 4 years. At that point, why the master, Montgomery, claimed that he had not been paid and sent bounty hunters to Iowa to bring Ralph back. And indeed, they obtained some type of a writ from a justice of the peace in Missouri, and that gave them enough authority that they seized Ralph and actually had him on the steamboat ready to take him back on the Mississippi River to Missouri. But one of his two of his friends, I believe it was, but one of them, Alexander Butterworth, a white man, sought a writ of habeas corpus, that he was being unlawfully held, in fact, alleging that he was kidnapped. And so the district court judge granted that writ of habeas corpus on a temporary basis and then expedited the case to the Iowa Supreme Court. And in the very first decision, and the court had a flair for the dramatic. They issued it on July 4 of 1839 and held that Ralph had been in free territory, even though we were a territory, we were part of the Northwest territory that where slavery had been denied. And the court held that he was not a fugitive. He had been allowed by his master to come. There was a full understanding he was coming to Iowa and that slavery was so odious that basically under natural law that unless there was a statute that authorized it in the country or in the state in which he was, that he was entitled to his freedom after being there for that length of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an exceptional case. It's also one, I think, that white Iowans can be really pleased by the key and critical role played by Butterworth to bring the habeas corpus action to get him off the boat, to give him a chance to be heard.
Don't we have to stand this up to next to the famous Dred Scott decision?
We certainly do, because that 18 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court on facts that are almost identical. I mean, Dred Scott had been a slave, and he had been in Illinois and in Minnesota that were also free territories. He had been there like for 4 years, accompanying his owner, who was a doctor in the U.S. military, and then he filed for suit in the Missouri courts. The Missouri courts candidly admitted that times are not now as they once were. And that while there had been Missouri precedent that likewise would have freed Scott based upon his 4 years in free territory, they reversed themselves and held that he continued to be a slave. He then went to the federal courts and brought the same suit. And indeed, if you go to if you go down to St. Louis and go by the arch. There is a great museum in the courthouse there where the case was tried that tells you a lot about the history of this story. But the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately, in a split decision and written by the Chief Justice Roger Taney, held that blacks and this is some of the most racist language that you'll ever read in a Supreme Court. Blacks were perceived at the time of the founding as so inferior that there were no rights that a white man had to respect, and they held that. It was not conceivable that even a free black could ever be a full-fledged citizen, have the right to sue in the federal courts. And that largely set the stage for the Civil War.
Russell Lovell, professor of law emeritus at Drake Law School, along with Ben Stone, our guest, former executive director of the ACLU of Iowa, recounting some of the highlights along Iowa's pioneering road through history. Iowa's the bright radical star. That's what Ulysses S. Grant called Iowa in 1868. Let's move into the 20th century. Ben Stone, as we recount people who took courageous actions to fight for their rights. Edna Griffin, tell us that story in the story of what happened at a drugstore, a building at least, that still exists in Des Moines, Katz Drugstore.
Yeah, after World War II... there was a drugstore in Des Moines that had been there for many years called the Katz Drugstore, and it barred African Americans, blacks, from using the lunch counter there. So this is much like you would see in the South. And Edna Griffin and others, Russ may remember, there was a gentleman that was very involved as well, that got involved, and they didn't do a lunch counter sit-in like you saw in the early 60s that was much more dramatic. But they boycotted Katz Drugstore. They were out front. They had picket signs. It was in the newspapers. Of course, there was no television at that time. And they picketed. There was a case brought. The 1884 Iowa Civil Rights Act was actually an act that required the government to bring the case. And or maybe that was – I guess I'm trying to remember now that maybe it was a private cause of action. Russ can correct me. He's a law professor that I had 20 years ago.
Well, actually, there were two lawsuits.
Yeah.
The prosecutor did bring – the county attorney brought suit under the criminal Iowa Civil Rights Statute, and then Griffin filed suit for a civil injunction and was represented by Charles Howard, one of the earliest black attorneys and one of Drake Law School's earliest graduates.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, anyway, but so what happened was that ultimately the case was decided in favor of Edna Griffin and her allies, and the Katz drugstore had to quit using segregation to keep blacks from using its facilities. And this was, you know, 7 years before the Montgomery bus boycott, 1949. It was 5 years before Brown versus Board of Education, and over 15 years before the Nashville lunch counter sit-ins in the early 1960s.
Interesting. Speaking of the 1960s, Tinker versus Des Moines, a big case that is in civil rights history. Russell Lovell, would you remind us what that was about in 1965?
Well, Tinker was a case involving Roosevelt high school students that were wanting to protest the Vietnam War, and they wore armbands to school in protest and then were disciplined by the school system with regard to that. And they brought suit in federal court alleging this was a violation of their First Amendment rights to free speech. And the case wound its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court took it probably one of its most protective views of First Amendment rights, particularly with regard to students, in concluding that indeed they did have a right to engage in that form of protest.
Mm-hmm.
Can I go back for one moment to the
yes.
Griffin case?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a Drake professor, I'd be remiss to not add that Drake students were very actively involved in that protest. John Bibbs and Leonard Hudson were among those students. The building in which the Katz drugstore was located was the Flynn Building. It was purchased by one of our alums, Roxanne Conlon, and her husband. And in 1998, on the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court of Iowa's decision, they renamed the building the Edna Griffin Building, honoring her civil rights and her peace activism, not just in that period, but really a lifetime of that kind of service.
We've asked this question earlier in the program, but I also want to ask it again because there are so many facets to the answer here. Why this tradition in Iowa? What are your thoughts on that? And I know, Russ Lovell, Justice Mark Cady of the Iowa Supreme Court has written an article about Iowa's pioneering spirit. How does that fit into this discussion?
The Chief Justice wrote an article that the Drake Law Review published, and it's a very readable article. I'd encourage people to look at it. Let me read a paragraph that I think kind of summarizes his perspective. He said that political and social ideas were not informed. It's called the Pioneer's Constitution. So he's talking about that era, that 1840s, that 1850s, 1860s era. The political and social ideas were not informed by tradition or ideology, but rather by practicality. On the frontier, everyone was equal because the conditions of life there were such as to make men plain, common, unpretentious, genuine. And he quotes then Governor Kirkwood from that era, quote, "We are rearing the Western Yankee, if you choose to call him so, the man of grit, the man of nerve, the man of broad and liberal views, mm-hmm. the man of tolerance of opinion, the man of energy, the man who will someday dominate this empire of ours."
So what sets Iowans, though, apart from Missourians and Nebraskans? So what was the difference there? Because they're all pioneers at this time, settling a new mm-hmm. land.
I'm not sure that the chief distinguishes or answers that question,
yeah.
I guess. But certainly, Iowa from its very start was in free territory, and not that there couldn't have been slaves that would travel through, but obviously Missouri was, as part of that Missouri Compromise, was a slave state. And so without a doubt, the attitudes of those who moved to those jurisdictions on slavery had, or may have had something to do with at least some of the individuals who came here.
Well, and I would think, Russ, as I recall, that the people that came to Iowa and settled it, you know, they were primarily from Ohio, Pennsylvania. I mean, it really wasn't a lot of Southerners. Mm-hmm. The man that wrote the Case of Ralph, I think, was a judge that came here from Ohio. And there were Quakers. There was this tradition of course, the abolition movement. I think the abolitionists were actually quite politically active. I mean, we had a governor that was a very outspoken abolitionist, and so I think the fact that we were not wrapped up in the slave debate. I mean, obviously,
in
Missouri,
fact, we were
Kansas,
a big part
Nebraska,
of the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad had a great tradition in Iowa.
We were kind of isolated from the battles and the really horrible stuff that went on down in Missouri and Kansas regarding slavery. And people could just kind of move to Iowa and this is just speculation. I have no evidence. But Ben, if there's one thing I could ask, Russ, the building that the Katz Drugstore was located in that has the plaque, I believe that building is at 7th and Locust. And is that not a building that might be getting torn down? I don't know if you read that in the paper.
I'm unaware of it being torn down, and that address sounds correct.
I think that's it's across from the Yonkers fire. So that's
Ben Stone, I understand you have another appointment. You've got to get away, but I want to ask you very quickly, because in light of all the things we've been lauding Iowa for, do you see any contradictions in Iowa history that don't jive with this tradition at being at the forefront of civil rights in current times?
Well, I think it's important to realize that, politics doesn't always identify what people are. I mean, obviously, Iowa for 100 years was an extremely Republican state. I mean, at one point, there were four Democrats in the Iowa legislature in the post-war years. But that doesn't mean that they're all the same, cut from the same cloth. I mean, I think that there was a tradition of Republicanism that was really quite different than you would find in other parts of the country.
But for instance, we have not yet, perhaps this election cycle, we will not elected a woman to Congress.
Well, yeah, there's an irony there that's about a whole week of conversation. I think we're all perplexed.
We have racial disparities in prison.
Yes.
These sorts of things. I know you have to go.
Iowa's not a utopia, but we should be pretty proud.
Ben Stone, I know you have to go. Former executive director of the ACLU, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much.
And Russell Lovell, stay with us for the next few minutes. Let's finish up and tie some loose ends here. What do you see out there as loose ends we want to get to before we have to end this conversation in five or so minutes?
I don't think we've spent enough time on the Clark versus Muscatine case, because I think when I look at the kind of the trilogy of cases that I refer to as kind of the golden era of civil rights of the Iowa Supreme Court in the 1800s, we talked about the Ralph case, the case that freed the slave. Camilla talked about the Coger case where the biracial woman teacher, was pulled off out of the first class dining area because she was of mixed race, and she sued and won an important jury verdict in the Iowa courts that was affirmed by the Iowa Supreme Court in very broad language. And I think Camilla said that the court was a little bit critical of her as a woman. Actually, my recollection was that they were actually spoke very favorably, admiringly of her asserting her rights and speaking out and trying to vindicate them in the courts. But I think of all those cases, the Clark case is on a whole nother plateau. And I say that because we've had it at Drake Law School for the last 20 to 25 years, a lecture series that's brought in almost all of the justices of the United States Supreme Court to speak. And invariably, we have an opportunity with our students and faculty to ask questions of the justices in a more informal setting. And to a person, whether they're considered a conservative or a progressive justice on that court, they've all answered that the most important case of the United States Supreme Court, most of them would say in its entire history, but at least in the 20th century, was Brown versus Board of Education, the case that overturned segregation of the public schools nationally. But Iowa reached that decision 86 years before that. I was really pleased to see Beth Townsend is the director of the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, and she took a project to the state fair this year and handed out over 300 T-shirts that talk about the Iowa Supreme Court's leadership role. The T-shirt has a picture of the nation saying – or it has the date of the Brown decision, May 17, 1954, and it says when the United States finally caught up with the state of Iowa.
Why? Why in all these cases is Iowa ahead of the U.S. Courts? What is the concise answer to that?
I don't think there is a concise answer, but I do think that part of it reflected the kind of welcoming and tolerance and the attitudes of our settlers. I think who immigrated here. I think I can't say enough about Alexander Clark's influence and the large commitment of African Americans who fought in that Civil War and came back and wanted to make Iowa their home. And I think just a sense of these folks are like just like anybody else, and they deserve to be treated. They've made the sacrifice. They should have the same benefits mm-hmm. of citizenship. The Clark case, you know, Susan Clark was a 12-year-old daughter of Alexander Clark. She wanted to go to the neighborhood school. There was a black school in Muscatine, but it was many, many blocks away, and it didn't provide the same kind of training. There had never been a black child who had gone to the colored school that had qualified to go on to high school. And so he brought suit, and the case went to the Iowa Supreme Court, and the court went through the legislative history. They looked at the language of the 1857 Constitution, and it was a courageous decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could have construed in 1858, 1 year after the Constitutional Convention, the state of Iowa had passed a statute that had said that black kids could go to a white school, but only if the white parents unanimously agreed to allow them to do so.
Russ Lovell, we have only a couple minutes left. Take us with all this great history you've been providing us with over the last hour, the context. Take us up to the present and give us your observations about the current court. Is the current court in keeping with this tradition?
Okay. I've got to get one more plug in on the Clark case. The author of the opinion in Clark was Justice Chester Cole. And I've given Iowa Law School a lot of shout-outs about Alexander Clark, but Justice Cole is the founder of the Drake Law School. He served as the dean from 1892 to 1907. So we are really proud of our connection to the Clark decision and his role in it.
Okay,
today, in the Varnum case, you know, as the court talked in terms of defining what is equality, and equality today, that's a dynamic, it went back and in the opinion spent at least three pages of that opinion discussing the trilogy of cases, the In re Ralph, the Clark versus Muscatine, Coger versus Northwest Union Packet, and the Arabella Mansfield being the first woman to be licensed as a lawyer in this country. And they talk about that tradition, and that's alive and well. They talk about that tradition was fashioned under the Iowa Constitution, and they acknowledge that when they interpret the Iowa Constitution, they may be persuaded by the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the federal Constitution, but they're not bound by it as long as they are creating more protective rights for Iowa citizens. And so that's been an important development since the year 2000. For a significant period from about the time that the federal courts became very active with the Brown versus Board of Education decision and for the first time really took the lead on civil rights in the Earl Warren era and even really during Warren Burger's era. But as Chief Justice Rehnquist became the chief in the court, they began to retrench and back off from progressive interpretation of those rights. And the Iowa Supreme Court and other state courts began to reassert themselves. And they've done that since the year 2000, starting with State versus Klein, a case involving protections of citizens with regard to search and seizure and individual rights involving protections in the criminal justice process. And so they've had not just the Varnum decision, but there's been numerous Iowa Supreme Court decisions since the year 2000 in which they have taken a more protective view of citizens' rights than the U.S. Supreme Court decided.
Russell Lovell, we have to leave it there. We've come to the end of our hour. Wow. What a wealth of knowledge you've provided us. Incredibly interesting and, I have to say, exhilarating insights. As an Iowan, I find it exhilarating to hear all this history. Russell Lovell, Professor of Law Emeritus at Drake Law School in our Des Moines studio. Thanks for coming in today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And tomorrow on this program, a News Buzz edition, but an unexpected News Buzz edition, including the birth of the butterfly. Not the butterfly, the monarch. The birth of the swim stroke, the butterfly, in the 1930s, can be traced back to Iowa. Find out more on that tomorrow. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.